So I got two of these left over here. I'm hoping not to take them home, so. They're $50 each. Oh, well. I'll sell them for $5, okay, tonight. So I'm going to read one out here. Let me find one. I'll read this one. Inventory. In the sunlight, I unloaded potatoes with a bunch of pimpled boys from West Mifflin, Pennsylvania. Their acne problem wasn't rooted in the whole of adolescence. The first day on the job, they wore their clear faces like new ball mitts. But luck may as well be a cocksucker. And instead of an ice cream stand with the girls as sweet and crispy as sugar cones, they were assigned to the potato patch to fry up thousands of pounds of potatoes. The thing is, they still got laid, sometimes by the equally pimpled girls who loved working in the patch more than anyone, just to show how tough they were in 100-plus degree heat, sliding over the greasy floor. I'm starting to remember just where I was that year, asleep on bags of sugar in the back of a fruit stand. Old Katie, who had the name of a little girl, would wake me to trade 5-gallon buckets of fruit she just cubed with her knife for new, abnormally large watermelons. Luck had it. So I met potato trucks each morning at 7 and then counted all the strawberries and boxes of cantaloupe in the park. Occasionally, I stumbled out back to puke under the great steel roller coaster. There was no reason to be there. I didn't want to buy anything I could have put in my pockets. What a fucking dope I must have been. At the end of summer, the only thing I owned were muscles and an exhaustion that lasted until Halloween. Each morning, I linked up with those boys in a chain and tossed 50-pound bags of potatoes from hand to chest, stacked them neatly in the back of the stand. About halfway into the summer, we would start to throw the bags as hard as we could, up high near the chin, to see if we could knock each other over, just for fun. Okay, and then I'm going to do one. Thank you. Let me find one more, because I'm going to, what did you say? Flip the what? Script. I'm going to flip the script. Okay, downtime in a bag factory. South Korea needs 7 boxes of bags, 1,000 bags per box, and it is quiet now because all the full-time guys who run the label makers are gone. Bad Brad stands across from me, pulling bags with a little hate and sloppiness, just like we pull ourselves out of bed each day and drive to this factory that sits behind a row of trees along Route 30, so we could hit the red button on the bag machine over and over. Brad runs the garbage bag machine out front, wants to buy his girlfriend a car, so he stays late with me to make the giant bags. It's our contribution to the end of the world, these bags folded up in 4-foot-tall cardboard boxes. Brad is not in love, but he has his heart set on a clean, late 70s Capri classic, just like the one my mother used to drive, I tell him, every time he mentions it. He's good, opens the back door to keep things a little chilly, us cutting the hours with each roll change and twist of the Allen wrench. Bad Brad, who sat on the far side of the high school lunchroom, is now my partner, and we hold no grudges. It would have made a lot more sense to be in a shop class with him than Spanish 2 with all the sophomore girls whose asses looked like 2 grade A eggs wrapped in a denim basket, but had no idea how to conjugate the verb bizarre. This is kind of old, so I'm forgetting. Where the hell did I come out with that one? Brad closes the back door for a cigarette break. Here comes the Sanders, whose whole nuclear family works different shifts, but are all off during opening day of buck season. We watch as the dad and mama make the long walk down the center of the shop, their blue and white igloo cooler slapping off the man's thigh. They look worried because me and Brad are set up on a newer machine, which doesn't need the blade changed as often, and makes it look like we're doing double the work. They never talk, not even when it's time to sit on a box and wash their sandwiches down with generic soda pop. I follow Brad outside to shake the fluorescent lights out of my oily hair. We talk about the company outing and how the owner won $1,200 on a long shot named County Commissioner, and how he's a nice old man, at least a tolerable boss, and it's a shame his son, the vanilla jerk whose hair is never out of whack, his shirt never soiled, will soon own all this space. We both shrug it off and watch Brad's orange cigarette nub spark across the gravel parking lot. I stop and drink from the fountain near the time clock and inhale the water as if I need to store it. While gone, the Sanners pirated the good machine, but it doesn't matter. We are there and not in love, and so what? The smaller machine is a bit more subtle, and I flick the red switch to on and get going with the steps. Here we go now. We hit the buttons at the same time for safety, and the machine turns plastic into bag. 1,000 bags per box, just like that. That that factory was sat at the same spot where Vogue Terrace used to be. I don't know, it was a little dance hall in Pittsburgh a while ago. But I'm going to read an article I wrote for Card Player magazine. It was published in December of last year, and it's about a Pittsburgher named Bob Stupak. And I'm just going to read it. Jutting out of the earth more than 1,000 feet into the air, the stratosphere in Las Vegas will be one of the first things aliens fly by if they ever happen to get here. It's easy to think that Bob Stupak had this at least in the back of his mind when he started daydreaming about building the Las Vegas landmark. Sitting in his office in his gaudy and gargantuan Lake Vegas world, Stupak thought of himself as Captain Kirk, quote, the guy who has to keep the Enterprise moving forward, unquote, he wrote in the foreword of one of his books called Yes, You Can Win, which W-I-N, exclamation point, in 1992. Vegas World even had a space-out theme with an astronaut floating up the side of one of the hotels, tethered to a roulette wheel. A life-size replica of the ill-fated Skylab space station hung in the main lobby along with another astronaut. The casino displayed thrusters from the space shuttle Columbia. The casino ceiling was dark with flickering lights, simulating stars. The casino's model, found encircling a pair of dice that added up to 11, was the sky's the limit. And in his introduction, Stupak, maybe Las Vegas' best promotional man, used himself as an example to his readers who maybe only wanted to know how to calculate odds at craps tables. Instead, they got a piece of Stupak's philosophy, and if they looked very close, the plea to value life as a precious gift and understand that time is the ultimate enemy to all. Quote, I felt a zing in my heart just thinking about it, unquote, he wrote, of his new project, just starting to rise out of the former car lot. These were the dreams of an eighth grade dropout. The Polish Maverick. Bob Stupak was born in Pittsburgh. He's born in up in the South Hills on April 6, 1944, to parents who clothed, fed, and housed their children by running numbers and spreaded floating table games, particularly craps. Quote, when I was a kid, I thought that's what big people did. You throw dice against the wall. That's the way I was raised forever, Stupak said in a must-have biography by John Smith, No Limit, The Rise and Fall of Bob Stupak in Las Vegas' Stratosphere Tower. After a series of raids, Chester and Florence Stupak became well-known in the Pittsburgh area as gambling operators, and by 1965 were charged with running gambling joints no less than six times. Chester was indicted in 1958 for running numbers in dice clubs and also bribing public officials, but nothing stuck. Quote, Chester Stupak was a man of stature in Pittsburgh's backroom casino circles. He was to illegal numbers in card rooms what Carnegie was to steel, unquote, Smith wrote. Chester owned the Lotus Club on Pittsburgh's South Side, with its windows painted black. It offered more than just drinking and gambling. Flyers advertising strippers were often found under the windshield wipers of cars along Sydney Street. The March 1st, 1958 front page of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette featured Chester getting led to the district attorney's office in handcuffs under the headline, Chester Gets Special Curb Service. Bob Stupak was 14 and already a middle school dropout, choosing instead to work several hustling jobs like selling cheap watches on the street, loaning small amounts of money, and running his own cards and craps games. Cheap watches were often given away to guests at Vegas World as part of an almost too-good-to-be-true promotion that was. Stupak would be fined multiple times for millions of dollars for violating consumer protection rules. During his teen years, Stupak also tried to sing under the name Bobby Starr and also drag race motorcycles. I couldn't find anything about the Bobby Starr connection. A lifelong motorcycle lover, he came within an eyelash of death on one in 1995. In the 1960s, Stupak left for Australia, where he married twice and also built a small financial empire wheeling and dealing two-for-one coupons. But he always wanted a casino and knew Vegas was the place to do it. So he returned to the city for good in 1971, borrowed money from friends and family, and began to earn his nickname, Mr. Las Vegas. He first bought the Vault Casino and revamped it to Bob Stupak's Glitter Gulch. He had a giant cowgirl made in neon nights to compete with Vegas Vic, the giant waving cowboy on Fremont Street, that big thing. So here was a guy, an outsider with no mob connection, who announced himself to the city by putting his name on a casino. He then bought a former car lot in the once destitute part of Las Vegas that used to be known as Naked City and built Bob Stupak's world-famous historic gambling museum and casino, a tiny establishment that opened on March 1974. Stupak joked the sign was longer than the building itself. It promptly burned down less than 60 days later. In its place, and with the help of a $1 million loan, he built his gaudy, space-themed Vegas world. More circus than the Golden Nugget, Stupak found a niche in the Las Vegas casino market. Even middle-class Americans wanted to leave their fat kids at home and gamble in Las Vegas. Through incessant mailings of envelopes stuffed full of coupons and freebies, Stupak turned his Vegas world from a 20-story, 100-room hotel that grossed $1 million annually into a 1,000-room monster that, at its peak, generated $100 million a year. Quote, if P.T. Barnum had a hedonistic twin, Bob Stupak might be the guy. He is one of the last of the great Las Vegas wild men. In an era in which corporations have placed their publicly traded USDA grade A stamp on the city, at a time in which gambling's most notorious party animals have begun posturing as elder statesmen of the Las Vegas Casino Society, Bob Stupak is still tearing up the neon-lighted streets with his big ideas, big bets, and big mouth, wrote John Smith. Along the way, Stupak ran for mayor of Las Vegas and was known as a, quote, a decathlon gambler, sports bets, propositions, poker, everything at once. He had a lot of heart and a lot of brains, said friend Lem Baker, a bookmaker, in Stupak's obituary that ran in the Las Vegas Sun. That's what cracks me up about a lot of these Vegas characters. If you gamble all night, you have a lot of heart and a lot of brains and a lot of guts. Instead of, not to mention a hell of a lot of money, but... A man always looking for publicity, he rarely made a move without notifying the press. He got attention by donating $100,000 to the United Negro College Fund to play with the Harlem Globetrotters. He placed and won a $1 million bet on Super Bowl XXIII, but he supposedly hedged his bet at halftime. He once bet the poker player Stu Unger $100,000 that Stu couldn't name the last card after the first 50 cards of a deck was exposed. Stu won. So basically, he sat at a table and he went all the way down to his one card and said, hey, Stu, what card was it? And the guy nailed it. But that's a whole other story. He was a legendary high-stakes poker player, regular in nosebleed games in the 70s and 80s, and he ran into financing trouble with the Stratosphere. He convinced his old poker buddy, Lau Berman, who was co-founder of casino developer Grand Casinos, Inc., to take over the project. Stupak was still a major investor, but the completion of the Stratosphere was out of his hands. 3 weeks later, Stupak was involved in a horrible motorcycle accident when his Harley-Davidson collided with a car on Rancho Drive. His 19-year-old son, Nevada, suffered a broken leg. Bob Stupak nearly died. He broke every bone in his face, but he survived. In 1996, Mayor Jan Jones declared him Mr. Las Vegas. He also appeared on Ripley's Believe It or Not, playing poker against a computer program by Mike Caro. He's a mad genius of poker. I mean, come on, you guys got to know that. He won the $250,000 challenge. His final cash in an event, a poker event, came in April of 2008 when he finished 91st at the WPT Championship. He was fighting leukemia at the time. Even before his close brush with death in 1995, Stupak's seize-the-day attitude was apparent. Again, from the introduction to his Yes, You Can Win, quote, "In this game of life, the house edge is called time. In whatever we do, nature charges us for doing it in the currency of time. So we must take advantage of every moment. Every moment in life is so very precious. You only get a fling at life for a while. Then the house collects. We must get all our thrills and all our experiences while we have the opportunity. We have to go for it now!" Exclamation point. And only by taking advantage of time in this way can we get the best of it. Win or lose. Stupak died September 25th, 2009. He was 67. Thank you. Thanks.